Stand by. Transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to the show this week. We have a lot going on, including talking to three doctors. Dr. Michael DeFranco is a sports physician, and he tells us how to be careful with our kids so that they don't get injured if they participate in a lot of physical activity. We also speak to Dr. Marvin Marshall, and he tells us why it's very important not to bribe your kids to succeed. And Dr. Patricia Raymond is here. She's a gastroenterologist, and she tells us how to deal with bloating, something we don't want to deal with, but we all have to undergo at some point. Lots to do. Let's go.
Capture your need for sound.
The media is full of reports of childhood obesity and what a problem it is. That's why, as parents and family members, we are thrilled if our kids actually enjoy physical activity and take to playing some sort of sport. The problem is we can't just let them get out on the field without the proper tools, and that means helping to make sure they don't suffer careless sports injuries. To help us figure out how to best take care of our kids during sports is orthopedic surgeon Dr. Michael DeFranco, who specializes in sports medicine and who also authored the book Surviving a Season. Dr. DeFranco, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Dr. DeFranco, I think a lot of adults take for granted that kids can actually really hurt themselves while playing their sports, and that, you know, that specific injury could turn into a lifelong sort of battle. What's the first thing you say to parents who want to get their kids into a sport?
I think the first thing to say is just to be mindful of the amount of activity that they're playing every week. Obviously, any sport requires an athlete to practice a certain amount, but children, no matter what age they are, between the ages of, 5 and 20 years old, there are different phases of growth that kids go through, and I think it's very important to be respectful as they grow, to be aware of the changes that are occurring in their body, and not put too much stress on their body so that they don't put themselves in a higher risk category for injury.
And is it true, Dr. DeFranco, that most injuries occur between the ages of 5 and 24?
A lot of the sports-related injuries, the recreational-related injuries that we've seen increasing over the past couple of decades are in that age group. We know that there are approximately 7 million of them occur, and about half of those occur between the ages of 5 and 24 years old.
And what are some of the most common sports injuries that kids face, and how do you avoid them?
I think some of the most common ones that people are probably familiar with are sprains. A sprain involves a soft tissue in the body around a joint. So a joint typically consists of a couple bones coming together, and those bones are held together by strong tissues, which you can think of as strong pieces of rope, and those we usually call ligaments. And when it is stretched in a way that it shouldn't go, then those ligaments can stretch out, and that's what we call a sprain. And there are varying degrees of injuries to those ligaments. They can just be stretched, they can actually tear, they can completely tear. Another type of injury is called a strain, which happens to a muscle. And a muscle attaches to a bone through a soft tissue, again, which is similar to a strong piece of rope called a tendon. So if the muscle stretches too much, or the muscle a tendon where it attaches to the bone stretches too much, that's what we call a strain. And again, there are varying degrees of severity of a strain. It can just be stretched, it can partially tear, it can completely tear. Another common one in the contact sports is what we call a contusion, where somebody receives a hard hit to, let's say, a football player to their thigh, or even a basketball player to their thigh, and there is some bruising around the area of the impact and the muscle that can cause pain and restriction in activity. One of them, it's not as common as a sprain, strain, or contusion, but definitely one that we're hearing more about is a concussion. And I think it's really important for every parent and coach to educate themselves about the importance of concussions, especially in young people, because this is an injury that can have a very significant long-term impact on ability of a child to develop and to really not only play sports, but really just well in school. And a concussion is similar to a contusion. It's really a strong hit to the head, and then there's some bleeding around the brain. The brain essentially becomes bruised, and it's very significant. Can be a significant injury, and then if there's any question about whether or not your son or daughter has sustained a concussion in the course of their athletic activity, they should not play anymore until they're examined by a doctor and they're cleared to go back by a doctor.
And, you know, Dr. DeFranco, I think some adults can actually get carried away, especially if their child or their player, you know, shows promise in a particular sport, and then they start training them harder, and maybe harder than they should be for that age. I'm assuming that for the kids' sake, you shouldn't be training them like a tiny adult.
Right, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is that the body of a child that's maturing is not the same as an adult body that's already mature and able to handle more stress as they participate in their athletic activity. And that's really something that parents need to be aware of when they train their kids. And I think it's also important to teach the kids the importance of rest. So, like every teenager, teenagers don't usually like to rest. Kids don't like to rest. It's usually nonstop, you know, going from one thing to another. They enjoy several sports or one sport. They'll play all the time. They want to play every day. But it's really important if a child is practicing, has an intense practice and intense training protocol, that they at least rest one or two days a week, which basically means they just take the day off. They don't do any athletic activity. They do something completely outside their sport to give their mind a break. And sometimes it's difficult not only to convince the kids of that importance, but also the parents, because they want to push them. You know, as parents and coaches, you want the kids to do well. You want them to excel. But there really has to be an understanding that a day of rest can actually be more beneficial than that extra day of intense activity, which can wear down the body and cause injury.
Joining us on the show is orthopedic surgeon Dr. Michael DeFranco, who specializes in sports medicine and who also authored the book Surviving a Season. Dr. DeFranco, does the environment also play a part in how our kids can get hurt or injured, you know, if it's extremely hot or cold?
Definitely. The you know, Mother Nature can definitely have an impact not only on athletic performance but also on the health of an athlete. And sometimes we kind of take this for granted. We say, yo, it's nice out. Oh, we're going to go outside and have football practice or soccer practice. And, you know, just as an example, if we say that happens on a summer day or a hot fall day, and kids can start to sweat and really overheat, and if they don't understand the importance of taking in water and hydrating themselves during their activity, that can have some significant consequences in terms of developing illness related to being overheated. So that's something very important to be aware of, you know, and that goes as well for people who are involved in winter sports, too, hockey, skiing. It's the same thing. You need to protect yourself from the environment, and staying hydrated, whether it's warm out or cold out, is a very important part of participating in athletic activity.
And Dr. DeFranco, a question I would have for you, because we have listeners that are, you know, listening from all parts of the world to the show. Mm-hmm. I know that in specific sports, and I think as kids get into high school, you know, it becomes very like, you know, it's about the team. And then I almost feel like it becomes like, in certain cases, like a mini cult where sometimes the parents aren't really aware of some of the training practices that go on. And for example, like training on a super hot day. I mean, we've heard the stories of kids dying, I guess, from effects of like heat exhaustion. What do you tell a parent whose kid, you know, has made it into some sort of elite team or a high school team where their training is quite rigorous and they don't really know what's going on?
I think it's important just to educate your child, to say, you know, if it's important for you to want to excel in athletic activity, then you have to be smart about what you're doing with your body and what the level of activity that you're having. And you help educate your kid by helping them identify situations that could be potentially dangerous, like overheating themselves on a hot day, not taking an adequate amount of water or nutritional supplement on that day to keep themselves well hydrated. I think those are very important things you do with your kid. But the other important thing to do is to talk to the coach. You know, it's not, this isn't just a one-sided conversation with your kid. You know, that should be really a team coach where the parents work with the coaches, and together you work with the athletes on the team and the athletic trainer. And there is at least one doctor involved in every team sport. So it should really be a team effort identifying potential risk factors. And there are even days where you would say, oh, there's a scheduled practice, but you would identify if it's particularly hot outside and it's very humid, and you say, well, you know what, we're supposed to have practice today, but it's really too dangerous, it's too hot outside, putting too many athletes at risk, and you say you can't reschedule the practice, or maybe you go to an indoor facility where kids are protected from the sun and it's not as hot, and you practice for a shorter amount of time that day. So it's really just kind of being aware, using common sense to protect the kids.
And Dr. DeFranco, what are the four core principles of physical fitness?
The four core principles are something that is talked about in the book, and it's really just an acronym that we use to discuss the important aspects of athletic activity. One is cardiovascular exercise, which basically means getting yourself in good shape, and that's usually any exercise that gets your heart rate above a certain level to get your body in shape and to build endurance. And those are things like running, hiking, cycling, doing an elliptical machine, running up and down stairs, that type of intense activity that really elevates your heart rate and helps improve your cardiovascular fitness. The second part of it is the O in core is for orthopedic exercises, and that really relates to stretching. A good stretching program to help keep your joints supple, and a good strengthening program to help build muscle strength. Muscles have many functions in the body. They provide strength for your athletic activity, and they also help protect your bones. So having a good stretching and strengthening program is very important. The third thing, the R in core refers to rest, and as we were talking about before, rest is a very essential component to optimizing athletic activity. If you don't rest, you wear your body down and you place it at risk for injury, developing, like I said, sprains, strains, all kinds of things, stress fractures to the bones can happen when you don't rest. So there really needs to, if you're going to commit yourself to being the best athlete you can be and getting yourself in good physical shape, you should commit yourself to recognizing the importance of rest. And the final component of the core principles is energize, and that really refers to having a healthy diet. And this is not only about taking in nutritious food and drink, but also avoiding things that are out there that are sometimes tempting for athletes to get involved with, like steroids or energy supplements. I think the approach to the steroids and the energy supplements should really just be that, you know, they're not healthy in the long term. They could have really bad effects on your health. And really, if you just think and work with somebody who knows a lot about a healthy diet, like a sports nutritionist or any nutritionist for that matter, that you can help develop a healthy diet that can support the level of activity that you want to participate in. So nutrition and rest are very important components, because to participate in strenuous athletic activity, your body needs to have energy. And if you're not taking in that energy through the food that you get and resting your body, then one, you're not going to be able to perform to the level that you want to, and number two, you're going to place yourself at risk for injury.
And Dr. DeFranco, what are your thoughts on kids getting massage therapy? Because if they're sort of, you know, out there rigorously, you know, doing their sport sort of week in and week out, can massage therapy benefit them as a form of prevention?
You know, I'm not a big proponent of massage therapy. I think it can be helpful for sore muscles, and it's not something I'm against, but I wouldn't say that it's necessary to spend a lot of money on massage therapy. I think, you know, a good day or two of rest, a good stretching program can really help muscles recover. I think another thing that's important is cross-training. So if your particular sport is, let's say you're a cross-country runner, you know, the best thing for you may not be to be running every day. You know, maybe you get, you cross train, you do other things that don't put as much stress on your body, but help to keep you in shape, like swimming or an elliptical machine or biking to help take some stress off of your legs. So massage therapy can be helpful for some sore muscles, but not required.
And a question I wanted to ask you as well, because I think it's very important, again, for the adults to sort of pay attention to, because if a kid does get injured, you know, especially like as you were speaking about before with, you know, getting concussions, how important is it that they fully recover before they get back out there? Because I think there's a lot of pressure, especially as they get into high school, you know, to be back out there with their buddies and to sort of suck it up. So, you know, what's your thoughts to parents and coaches and even to the young athletes themselves, that they see the big picture?
Yeah, there are a couple of things, like you said. Oftentimes people just say suck it up or shake it off, or, you know, people use the phrase no pain, no gain. And I think these really reflect a poor understanding of trying to protect the athlete and optimize athletic performance. When you get hurt or your body's in pain, it's in pain for a reason. And that's basically your signal that you should stop playing and rest until that pain goes away. Anybody who's playing with pain or trying to play with an injury or just trying to play through it is really just asking to sustain a significant injury, make the injury that they have worse, or get another injury that they don't already have. And in many cases, we see this where kids try to play through the pain, or they go out, they play with pain, and what starts out to be a very simple injury that could probably have been treated with surgery and they'd probably recover in 3 to 4 weeks can turn into something that's something more significant that may require surgery and keeps them out of their athletic activity for the season. So, I would say stop and think before you go out and play with an injury or play with pain. I mean, the smartest thing to do is if you're in pain, rest, tell your coach about it, tell your parents about it, go get checked by a doctor. And worst case scenario is you might have to rest, go to some physical therapy for a couple of weeks, but get yourself healthy and pain-free before you return to the field to play.
And Dr. DeFranco, where can people get a copy of your book?
But they can either contact me directly or they can go to, I think it's available on Amazon.com. But they can also go to survivingaseason.com, the website for the book. And if there are coaches out there that are listening and they need multiple copies of the book, you can just contact me directly through the information on the webpage for Surviving the Season. I just want to go back to something that you had mentioned before, because I think it's really important about the nutrition aspect of this, especially in female athletes. There's something that we talk about called the female triad. For females, maintaining a regular menstrual cycle is very important to maintaining strong bones. And the term female triad refers to a combination of a loss of menstrual cycle, either they lose it or it's irregular, which can result in poor bone, loss of bone, and then that can ultimately result in something that we call a stress fracture, which means that if your bone is weak, then repetitive activity and stress on the bone can actually cause it to break. So especially in female, good nutrition is important in male and female athletes, but particularly in female athletes, they should be aware of the fact that if they don't have regular menstrual cycles, they should talk to their doctor about it, and that nutrition is also a very important component to maintaining strong bones to avoid this problem that we call stress fractures.
Thanks, Dr. DeFranco. You've been amazing. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
That's orthopedic surgeon Dr. Michael DeFranco, again, who specializes in sports medicine and who also authored the book Surviving a Season. And check that out, www.survivingaseason.com.
Relax. Release. Reflect.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Well, it's sad to say, but it seems as if actor Charlie Sheen has completely gone off the deep end. As you know, in the last few days and last week, he's just been granting all these interviews with radio stations and television shows and making all these accusations and saying all these things about himself that seems very erratic, very wild, very over the top. And it's completely been damaging to his career. It says something when your own publicist decides to quit because they can't handle all the information and the crazy that you're putting out to the public. So it's very disconcerting. I've seen Charlie interviewed several times in the past, and he seems like a nice guy. Seems like a lot of people would want to listen to him and to hang out with him. But I don't know what has brought this on, if it's the amount of drugs over time that he's taken that is completely blowing the lid off his sanity. I don't know what it is, but there's genuinely something not right with the boy. And I feel very bad because he does have a family to support. And, I know he does have a lot of money with regards to all the money he's been racking up being on 2.5 Men these last several years. But it just seems like he better hold on to that money fairly tightly, because I don't know which network or which, movie would give him another chance to be on their team, because his behavior is so erratic that you can't really count on him, I don't think, to show up and actually do the job. So he's completely unraveled. And I wanted you to listen to an interview that particularly disturbed me. It was with ABC News and Andrea Canning. And you'll hear for yourself just how much he is completely sort of unraveled and is in some sort of meltdown. And, you know, here's to hoping that he actually just stops the madness and can get himself together. And from there, hopefully he'll be able to resurrect some sort of a career, because right now things definitely not going his way.
Your anger and your hate, I think, is coming off as erratic to people.
Passion. My passion. It's all
okay,
passion.
Your passion,
yes,
is coming off as erratic,
right,
to people.
Right. Well, you borrow my brain for 5 seconds and just be like, dude, can't handle it. Unplug this bastard. Yeah, because it just, it fires in a way that is, I don't know, maybe not from this particular terrestrial realm.
I think some of those things that you're putting out there are making people think something's wrong with you.
That has nothing to do with me, really. I mean, they're entitled to, I suppose, interpret stuff as they must.
Some
are you a doctor of?
Some are saying that you're bipolar.
Wow, what does that mean?
I guess that, you know, you're on two ends of the spectrum.
Wow, and then what? What's the cure? Medicine? Make me like them? Not gonna happen. I'm bi-winning. I win here and I win there. Now what? If I'm bipolar, aren't there moments where a guy like crashes and like in the corner, like, oh my God, it's all my mom's fault? Shut up. Shut up. Stop. Move forward.
Have you had any celebrities reach out to you to
oh,
try
yeah.
and help you?
Who? Yeah, like radical people like Sean Penn and Mel Gibson and Colin Farrell and just radical people. And they're not telling me what to do.
Who gave you the best piece of advice?
Oh, they didn't give me any advice. And within that, there's great advice. It was just love. And so, you know, just to see, it's oftentimes says unknown, but occasionally, you know, a giant marquee name comes through on your caller ID and it's like winning.
When was the last time you used?
I use a blender, I use a vacuum cleaner, I use, household items. When was the last time I ingested or took drugs?
Yes, when was the last time you took drugs?
Such an AA stupid expression or term. I don't remember. I do not remember.
A week ago, 2 weeks ago, 2 days ago?
Maybe a month ago, 6 weeks. I don't know. It was a couple days before the suits rolled in and said, change it, change everything, we're shutting you down.
Tell me about the last time you took drugs.
The last time I took drugs, I probably took more than anybody could survive, you know.
What are we talking about? How much?
I don't know, man. I was banging 7-gram rocks and finishing them because that's how I roll. I have one speed. I have one gear. Go.
How do you survive that?
Because I'm me. I'm different. I just have a different constitution. I have a different brain. I have a different heart. I have a different, you know, I got tiger blood, man.
You don't worry that you're going to die when you take that many drugs?
Dying's for fools.
But you're only human.
Now, there's certain blends I will not entertain, because that's how people go down. I'm too smart to do that. So, you know, I'm sorry for the guys that happened to, but, you know, you should have read the directions before you showed up at the party, you know.
So you actually have a strategy about how you take your drugs?
No, I just have a couple of rules. I don't know if it's a strategy.
You're clean right now.
Sure.
So is this better now? Your life now, clean with your children.
Yeah,
is
no,
it
it's
better
perfect.
Than
it's not
being
better.
On drugs?
It's perfect. It's perfect. Yeah. No, it doesn't compare. They're whole different realities, you know. There's great things about both, but what I'm harnessing now is absolute, you know, focus. Mm-hmm. It's exciting. It's exciting. I've come back from a place that, you know, people can put labels on it and they can figure all this stuff out. They can try to like normalize it, boring, stupid, you know, and that's fine. But for me, it's I've just answered to a higher calling, and it happened in a blink of an eye, and I'm totally excited by it, you know.
Are you worried you're going to relapse?
No.
Why?
Because I'm not going to, period, the end.
But how do you
I blinked and I cured my brain. That's how. Everybody has the power, just because everybody, you know, can't is the cancer of happen. Mm-hmm. Can't is the cancer of happen. I can't do it. The Nike slogan doesn't say, just try it. Oh, okay. Just try it. No, just do it, man.
But you love to party.
I mean, what's not to love?
Especially
when you see how I party, man. It was epic. The run I was on made Sinatra, Flynn, Jagger, Richards, all of them just look like, you know, droopy-eyed, armless children.
When you look back at the last time you used drugs, mm-hmm. Are you disgusted with yourself? Or do you
think, how
could I have done that?
I'm proud of what I've created. It was radical.
You're proud of that party moment?
Of course. Why wouldn't I be?
Drugs?
No,
Why would you be?
Because I expose people to magic. I expose them to something they're never otherwise going to see in their boring, normal lives. And I gave that to them. I may forget about them tomorrow, but they'll live with that memory for the rest of their lives. And that's a gift, man.
One of the women said that she was afraid she might OD. One of the women who was here.
What's that got to do with me?
You're showing them the party.
That's got nothing to do with me. That's mm-hmm. all on her. And if she does, I'm sorry.
You say that you like the feeling of being on drugs, and it's
not
exciting
anymore,
and fun.
Not anymore. It bored the hell out of me after a while. I was like, okay, let's try something else.
How can anyone believe that you will stay clean, given your track record?
I'm not interested in what people believe. I'm interested in what I believe, and I believe in the truth. And that's what rules me.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Have you ever bribed your child so he'll stop freaking out in the grocery store? Or how about punishing him by taking away his favorite video game if he's been teasing his younger sibling? Most parents routinely offer a system of rewards and punishments to keep their kids in line and motivate them to act responsibly. But according to internationally known educator, author, and discipline expert, Dr. Marvin Marshall, these tactics are outdated, counterproductive, and stress-inducing. So you know what? Let's find out how to fix these issues. Dr. Marshall, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. It is my pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Marshall, how do parents sort of fall into the trap of trying to bribe their kids? And on top of that, it seems like it must be a difficult behavior to get out of.
It's not difficult if you have a different approach. To answer the first part of the question, and how do people do it, or why are they doing it, it's because it's happening across the world. Especially since the 1960s, when a fellow by the name of B.F. Skinner introduced what we call behaviorism. And the idea being that if you want people to do what you would like them to do, then you must reward them for doing it. And so as a result, teachers are giving stickers for kids, and parents feel that they have got to give a kid a sucker to be quiet in the grocery store. And, of course, what happens is that the youngster gets older, the sucker is not enough. By the time the kid is in high school, he wants a Porsche or some expensive automobile. It's because people have fallen into the idea that an external approach is the best way to influence people. And so they use bribes, and they also use imposed punishments or threats or fear of being punished. Both of these are different sides of the same coin. Rewards say, what do you want me to do, and what will I get if I do it? And punishments say, what do you want me to do, and what will happen to me if I don't do it? They're both external approaches, a product of the 1960s.
Okay.
Years ago, before then, a parent did not reward a youngster for doing what the parent expected. It was expected for the youngster to do it. So let me give you a quick story of how rewards change motivation, and this is critical to understand, okay?
Yep.
An elderly gentleman lived in the corner house, and every day a bunch of 10-year-old boys would come around, and they would taunt him. They would jeer him and throw rude remarks on him. They were having fun. So one day, as this elderly gentleman saw the boys come around the corner, he approached them, and he said, you know, I live alone, and I'm really enjoying the attention you're giving me. Do it again tomorrow, and I'll give each of you a dollar. Well, right after school the next day, there were the kids throwing him rude remarks. True to his word, he put down his gardening tools, went up to them, pulled out a roll of dollar bills, and gave each one a dollar, and say, do it again tomorrow, and I'll give each of you a quarter. Well, 25 cents is 25 cents. Next day, there were the boys at the school, throwing rude remarks at him. Again, true to his word, he put down his gardening tools, walked up to them, pulled out a roll of quarters, 25-cent pieces, and gave each one a quarter and said, do it again tomorrow, and I'll give each of you a penny. Do you think the kids came back?
Probably
you
not.
You see, probably not, because when the reward was gone, so were they. And
okay.
Here's the point. What the sly guy did is he started to offer a reward. And when the reward was gone, so were the kids. Point, rewards change motivation. If you give a kid a reward, for example, reading a book, you will never know if the kid is doing it to get the reward or because it's the right thing to do.
Dr. Marshall, if, you know, the kids get used to bribes, I'm assuming that, you know, is a dangerous trait that could sort of maybe damage their well-being, you know, later in life when it comes to their career aspirations and even, you know, how they deal with their peers.
Correct. It's counterproductive and it's unfair because the message to the kids is that society is going to reward you. Have you ever been rewarded for stopping at a red light or reward for standing in line? Society doesn't operate this way. We are literally lying to young kids and feeding them information, which, as you say, is going to be not to their best advantage.
Okay. And then on the other side of the coin, does punishing them also cause behavioral problems?
It can. But my point about punishing is that it is not the best way to change behavior. An imposed punishment where the youngster is given a threat or is punished, if the kid has no ownership in it, what happens is the kid resents it. Unless the kid knows that the person giving the reward is doing it for the kid's own best interest, and the kid has a relationship with the parent. But as the kid gets older, what happens is punishments don't work. Imposed punishments, a much more effective approach is simply, instead of imposing the punishment, here is the key word, elicit the consequence or elicit the punishment from the kid. It goes like this. What you're doing is not acceptable. What can we do? What procedure can we do so that it won't happen again? Now, the reason why this is so effective is because people don't argue with their own decisions. The youngster is the one who volunteered, who chose the punishment or the consequence or the procedure to help the kid help himself. So I'm not against all punishments, but an imposed punishment is not nearly as effective as one that's elicited from the kids, because as long as you use a coercive approach to impose something, the kid is going to resent it.
Okay, I understand that. Joining us on the show today is educator and author of Discipline Without Stress, Punishments, or Rewards, Dr. Marvin Marshall. Make sure you check him out, www.marvinmarshall.com. Dr. Marshall, can you tell us, because I was reading some of the information on your website, how the bribing and punishing can cause a stressful environment in the home itself?
Well, number one, it causes stress for both the parents and for the youngster, because if the parent offers a reward and the kid does not follow what the parent is offering, then it prompts stress. Here is the key about rewards. The person has got to be interested in it. So, for example, we've got all kinds of rewards that we give for kids, such as grades. And I've got a wonderful story in the book about a youngster who got all A's, and then the next report card, he got 1A, 2Bs, and the rest C's. And when the principal, the parent went to the school and found out what the problem was, and the kid was called in, and he just said, I didn't need the money, because the parent was bribing the kid for a grade. Here's the point, succinctly as I can make it. An incentive works if the kid is interested in the incentive. We've got all kinds of kids who are not interested in getting good grades, and a reward is not going to prompt them. If you get seasick and they have this contest where the prize is a cruise, it's not going to be much of an incentive for you. So the reason why offering rewards is one of many can cause stress is, the parent offers the reward, but the kid is not interested in it. And so the kid, therefore, doesn't do what the parent wants.
And a question too, Dr. Marshall, just sort of using my own life as an example. You know, I grew up on a farm, and obviously there's a bunch of responsibility that comes with that. And so, you know, myself and my two siblings, we pretty much knew very early on that we were expected to do certain things, and that's just the way it was. So we weren't ever really rewarded for, you know, getting good grades or, you know, taking care of the cows and what have you. But certain times throughout our lives, my parents would buy us stuff on occasion. And, you know, and sometimes it would be, you know, well, you did extremely well on this and we're really proud of you. So we're happy to get you this, you know, pair of running shoes or whatever it was. But more often than not, it was ingrained in us that to behave well and to do well in school was expected. So then this occasional reward was kind of just like, you know, the cherry on the cake, I guess, if you want. Is that something okay to do, sir?
Absolutely. And you described it beautifully. What your parents did was they acknowledged you after the fact. You see, if you say you do this and you're going to get that, that's a bribe. Rewards can be, they can be great as incentives, they can be great as acknowledgments, but to give a kid a reward for doing what the kid should be doing is counterproductive. Your parents never did it, and my guess is you are a much happier individual than if you were brought up as so many kids today where they are accustomed to getting rewards. My entire education book and my parenting book, Parenting Without Stress, at parentingwithoutstress.com, the entire thrust is how do you have kids want to do what you would like them to do without bribes or threats. The entire thrust is to promote responsible behavior, and rewards and punishments can never do that because they do not create desire. They promote obedience, and obedience simply does not create desire.
And Dr. Marshall, how do you sort of, you know, make your child take responsibility for their actions? I know you gave us an example earlier, but it feels like with all the information you've been putting out there that it all boils down to pretty much accountability and responsibility. Is that fair to say? And then also, how do you elicit that constant responsibility coming from your child?
The entire book is how to do it. I have the following approaches. Number one, you've got to teach procedures. Parents assume and teachers assume that young people know what to do without first teaching them. The second part of the approach is three practices. Number one, be positive with people. Number two, they've got a choice anyway, so give them options. And number three, you cannot change another person. People change themselves. And once you realize this, then the question is, what's the most effective way to influence a person to change? And it will never be through coercion. This program is totally not coercive. The key is to learn how to ask reflective questions. And here's one that teachers and parents ask on a regular basis. Why are you doing that? And the kid says, I don't know, or I've got ADD. That's a pothole question. So the only skill that needs to be learned, and anybody can learn it, is learning how to act, to ask reflective questions such as, if you could do this over, what would you do? What would an extraordinary person do in this situation? If you could not fail, what would you do? So you're eliciting from the kid, you're empowering the kid. So again, procedures, and then these three practices, and then the big key is, instead of being reactive after a kid does something, you become proactive. You teach what I refer to as the raised responsibility system, where you teach four vocabulary words, and primarily kids get to understand the difference between external motivation of cooperating or democracy of internal motivation of doing it because it's the right thing to do. And you will never get the satisfaction of doing things what people tell you to do as if you do it because it's your own best interest and it helps other people.
Dr. Marshall, I just find all of your stuff so fascinating, and I want to help out, you know, parents that are out there right now that have maybe fallen into this trap of bribing the child or like you said, maybe punishing them and not in the appropriate way. How can people get a copy of your book, sir?
The easiest way is to go to marvinmarshall.com and then click on products. Or you can go right to parentingwithoutstress.com or in the discipline book, disciplinewithoutstress.com. But you can all get everything from my website, marvinmarshall.com. It's all there. I give all the information away, but if you really want to hone in on the skills, then you should have the book, either the parenting book or the education book.
Dr. Marshall, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Marvin Marshall, educator and author of Discipline Without Stress, Punishments or Rewards. And again, make sure you check him out, www.marvinmarshall.com.
Capture your need for sound.
Something that we don't often want to discuss is what is going on with our bellies. Specifically, if we suffer from that uncomfortable feeling of being bloated, it can be embarrassing, and we often suffer in silence. To help us get over ourselves and deal with the issue is gastroenterologist Dr. Patricia Raymond, who is also the author of several books, including Colonoscopy is a Gas. She's also been featured on redbookmag.com in the article 10 Ways to Beat Bloating. Dr. Raymond, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thank you so much, Kelly. Good to be here with you.
Now, Dr. Raymond, first and foremost, what are some of the top ways to beat bloating? And I guess I should ask you first off, what is bloating? And then, you know, what are some of the ways to beat it?
Well, the hardest problem here is what is bloating, because that leaves your doctor sitting there going, geez, I don't know either. Bloating is one of those very soft terms where everyone knows what it is, but nobody knows the definition. It's kind of a feeling of distension. It's kind of a feeling of fullness. It doesn't necessarily have to do with passage of any sort of gas from any sort of orifices. It's just this kind of vague feeling that something's not quite right. And the problem that we have is you can feel bloated because it's near time for your menstrual cycle, or you can feel bloated because you had your Boston baked beans for lunch, you know, or you can feel bloated just because of any sort of vague feeling of discomfort in your lower abdomen. The problem we have is that more recently they've actually found the word bloating, kind of with parentheses and quotations around it. Bloating might be the earliest symptom of ovarian cancer. So it's no longer enough for us to say, oh, you're just feeling a little bloated, honey. We've got to actually decide if this bloating is something for real that needs to be concerned about. Is this ovarian cancer? Or is this bloating you've just been eating a lot of cauliflower and broccoli and Brussels sprouts recently? So bloating is kind of a minefield of a phrase. We don't know what to do with it.
Okay. And then with regards to the actual feeling itself and feeling that discomfort that you're talking about, what are some of the ways that you can sort of deal with it?
Well, you have to do a little bit of scientific inquiry with yourself to try to figure out what the bloating is about. If the bloating is perimenstrual, if you know, based on your calendar that it's next week is the red mark day and you're bloating because it's menstrual cycle related, then it's certainly something to talk to your family practitioner, your internist, or your GYN about, because there's some really good medications now for the bloating related to menstrual cycles, which we sort of think is due to some fluid retention, but it's also due to some changes in how your GI tract actually moves. So that bloating we might be able to pharmacologically help. Now, if you're talking about bloating being gas, I mean, if you're actually kind of feeling gassy, you're actually kind of distended, you might even be passing more gas, then you have to be a bit of a detective about what it was you ate. The drugs we have to actually absorb gas are not incredibly great. So it's more a matter of what was it that you were eating that you don't want to eat the next time you have to put on your like for a cat suit. You know, what was the stuff that you were putting in you that you might want to avoid? Some of the big actors are some of the most healthy foods that you can possibly eat, the cruciferous vegetable family, like broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cause an enormous amount of gas, enormous amount of bloat, and yet are pound for pound some of the best stuff you can eat to prevent various cancers and other medical conditions. So you got to kind of try to figure out, if you were eating something, what was it? Do you need to avoid it? Do you need to take some dietary supplements to avoid it? And if we can't figure out what it is, sometimes we'll just give you some medications like some activated charcoal to absorb it.
And in the article itself, 10 Ways to Beat Bloating, there's a fair mention of food. Is there any particular reason that, you know, certain types of foods are so potent in the fight against bloating?
Yeah, and that's mostly because the action of our small intestine. The small intestine is about 26 feet long. It goes from the bottom of your stomach to the entry into the colon. And that's the area where we absorb all our nutrients. The lining of the small intestine is kind of finger-like fronds, what we call villi. And the nutrients actually absorb through these villi and get absorbed into your system. Now, the villi actually contain the various enzymes that help us to break down the food so they can make it into the villi. And so if you're missing any of the enzymes, that's where you're getting your bloating and that's where you're getting your gas. The most common enzyme to be missing in America would be lactase, which is the enzyme that breaks down the sugar lactose. So if you're eating milk sugar, whether it's in your yogurt, whether it's in your milk, whether it's in your ice cream, it goes downstream in the small intestine. You're lacking some amount of the enzyme because most people aren't absolutely lactose intolerant. They're just somewhat lactose intolerant. The enzyme's not enough there. You absorb the milk you can. The milk you can't absorb goes downstream. The bacteria that live in your gut eat it and make gas and bloating for you. So you really got to pay attention to what goes in your mouth, because that definitely causes a lot of the bloating.
Joining us right now is Dr. Patricia Raymond, gastroenterologist and author. Make sure you check her out at yourhealthchoice.net. Dr. Raymond, does exercise help as well to sort of deal with bloating? Does moving around, you know, sort of shake things up and maybe stop the bloating?
We think that it does. We have some studies that suggest that at least in some people, if you get out and move after you've eaten, it actually helps your stomach and helps your GI tract to kind of peristalsis downstream, to kind of move the material downstream and to help out the bloating. The data is really not strong scientific data, because it's certainly hard to go out and walk for 15 or 20 or 30 minutes with various probes hanging out of you while we're measuring how things are moving. But we do think that moving is very effective in many people to combat the feeling of bloating.
And you mentioned earlier about menstruation. Is bloating inevitable during, you know, sort of that time of the month, or are there tips that can sort of alleviate that as well?
Oh, heavens. I don't know that it's inevitable. It seems like some people have more complaints of bloating than others. There's some suggestion that patients can be helped out with a mild diuretic tablet. Some other suggestions that might indicate that if you took some magnesium salts or some multivitamins, that might help the bloating. Again, our problem here is that bloating is so subjective. It's such a soft symptom that it's hard to actually say what to do with this.
And with regards to, I guess, certain types of people, is it very sort of specific to who you are? Could it be like runs in the family that bloating is an issue? Like, how does that, is it genetic, I guess, is what I'm asking you?
I think it might be partially a learned behavior. Sometimes when you have family issues like bloating, it's not clear whether the bloating runs in the family or the reactivity of the gut to issues runs in the family. Certainly we know that some of the food intolerances, celiac disease, lactose intolerance, are more common in families, are more common in various races. So, you know, bloating being such a major bucket of a catchphrase, you could be a bloated person because mom was a bloated person, but I don't know if that's just because you're reacting as a bloated person or because you're actually lacking enzymes just like dear old mom lacks enzymes.
Okay. You know, we talked earlier about food choices and making, you know, being a bit of a detective, I guess, to find out which, you know, foods are causing these symptoms. Is there specific foods that, like, combat the bloating, like, or is it really like you need to pick out the ones that are causing you problems?
We don't have any overall foods that just suck up bloating and make it all better. As far as substances that can make bloating better, interestingly enough, we do believe that if you take products that have activated charcoal, now activated charcoal is like powdered charcoal, powdered carbon that's superheated under steam, and it makes it have the billions of pores per little dust particle of charcoal, kind of like a lava rock if you looked at it under a microscope. We think that activated charcoal actually will absorb any gas that you might be making. So, you know, that substance may help a lot of people with gas or bloating. However, we want to point out to you that not only does the charcoal suck up the gas, but it would also suck up anything else that's down there with it. So if you're taking any significant medications, you'll suck right up into the charcoal as well. That's why we use activated charcoal in overdose situations in the emergency department. So, you know, your only option of something to add in isn't a foodstuff, but it's a charcoal. But the question of what to delete is just a fascinating topic for most of my patients, because you really can't just immediately set your finger on it when you're saying, well, I'm feeling bloated right now. What was it that I ate? Because it could be something very inconsequential. We find that people get bloated if they eat, you know, maybe you just had one stick of sugar-free gum, and now you're feeling bloated. That one stick of sugar-free gum was quite a while back. Some people don't even experience their bloating, their fullness, until over 4 hours after they ate the thing.
Really?
So we suggest that, it takes a long time for the food to go down and get down the stomach and down the small intestine and whatever portion malabsorbs to get to the colon bacteria and make the gas. So, you know, your remembrances of what you ate exactly 4 hours ago, you know, at this point in your day, if you think back 4 hours to whatever your last meal was, what in heaven's name could you have had that was bloating? And if you're a person who, you know, has kids or stuff, you're probably mopping up little bits and pieces of food that you don't even think that you ate the substance, but there was a bite and you finished it up. So I have my patients actually do a written food diary. Everything that goes into your mouth, you write down, and you write down the time that the gas and the bloating is being perceived. Because you've got to try to get some sort of a union between what you're eating and the gas. But the timing is so disparate, it's hard to get it figured out.
Thank you so much. That's gastroenterologist and author Dr. Patricia Raymond. Again, check her out, www.yourhealthchoice.net.
Bring on the
Remix.
Tracy Young remix on the Kelly Alexander Show. Well, a big shout out going to my three guests this week, Dr. Michael DeFranco, Dr. Marvin Marshall, and Dr. Patricia Raymond. They were all amazing, and it was so wonderful to have all their different insights and advice on the specific topics that they were speaking about. And if you have any questions or topic ideas for me, I always appreciate it. You know, we like to cover as many subjects and different things going on around the world as we can to bring attention to them. So if you have something that you think that I should be touching upon, by all means, drop me a note, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com. Also want to give a shout out to our new producer on the Kelly Alexander Show. She's doing a fantastic job. So thank you, Talia Rotondo. Fantastic. We're happy to have you aboard the team. Also to Mario Butino, our marketing director, for bringing her on board. So have a great week. Always happy to chat with you. Keep checking our Facebook and Twitter page, and you know, because we'll be putting lots of updates on there as per usual. Also my blogs at kellyalexandershow.com. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Pare, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.